Yet he could not grasp what Dominique had done to inspire that mounting dread within him. He could find no word or gesture for which to reproach her. But for 20 months it had been like tonight. He could not bear to remain alone with her, yet he did not want to escape her, and she did not want to avoid him. "Nobody's coming tonight?" he asked tonelessly, turning away from the fire. "No," she said, and smiled, the smile serving as connection to her next words. "Shall I leave you alone, Peter?"
"No."
It was almost a cry. I must not sound so desperate, he thought, while he was saying aloud, "Of course not. I'm glad to have an evening with my wife all to myself." He felt a dim instinct telling him that he must solve this problem, must learn to make their moments together endurable, that he dare not run from it, for his own sake more than hers. "What would you like to do tonight, Dominique?"
"Anything you wish."
"Want to go to a movie?"
"Do you?"
"Oh, I don't know. It kills time."
"All right, let's kill time."
"No, why should we? That sounds awful."
"Does it?"
"Why should we run from our own home? Let's stay here."
"Yes, Peter."
He waited. But the silence, he thought, is a flight, too, a worse kind of flight. "Want to play a hand of Russian bank?" he asked.
"Do you like Russian bank?"
"Oh, it kills time."
He stopped. She smiled.
"Dominique," he said, looking at her,
"you're so beautiful.
You're always so utterly beautiful. I always want to tell you how I feel about it."
"I'd like to hear how you feel about it, Peter."
"I love to look at you. I always think of what Gordon Prescott said. He said that you were God's perfect exercise in structural mathematics. And Vincent Knowlton said you're a spring morning. And Ellsworth said you're a reproach to every other female shape on earth."
"And Ralston Holcomb?" she asked.
"Oh, never mind," he snapped, and turned back to the fire. "I know why I can't stand the silence," he thought. "It's because it makes no difference to her at all whether I speak or not, as if I didn't exist and never had existed. The thing more inconceivable than one's death, never to have been born." He felt a sudden desperate desire which he could identify, a desire to be real to her. "Dominique, do you know what I've been thinking?" he asked eagerly.
"No. What have you been thinking?"
"I've thought of it for some time, all by myself. I haven't mentioned it to anyone, and nobody suggested it. It's my own idea."
"Well, that's fine.
What is it?" "I think I'd like to move to the country and build a house of our own." "Would you like that?"
"I'd like it very much.
Just as much as you would."
"You want to design a home for yourself?"
"Hell no, Bennett will dash one off for me. He does all our country homes. He's a whiz at it."
"Will you like commuting?"
"No, I think that will be quite an awful nuisance, but you know everybody that's anybody commutes nowadays. I always feel like a damn proletarian when I have to admit that I live in the city."
"Will you like to see trees and a garden, and the earth around you?"
"Oh, that's a lot of nonsense. When will I have the time?" "A tree's a tree. When you've seen a newsreel of the woods in spring, you've seen it all."
"Will you like to do some gardening? People say it's very nice, working the soil yourself."
"Good God, no. What kind of grounds do you think we'd have? We can afford a gardener and a good one. So the place will be something for the neighbors to admire."
"Will you take up some sport?"
"Yes, I'll like that."
"Which one?"
"I think I'll do better with my golf. You know, belonging to a country club right where you're one of the leading citizens in the community is different from occasional weekends. And the people you meet are different, much higher class. And the contacts you make." He caught himself and added angrily, "Also, I'll take up horseback riding."
"I like horseback riding.
Do you?" "I've never had much time for it." "Well, it does shake your insides unmercifully. But who the hell is Gordon Prescott to think he's the only he-man on earth and plaster his photo and riding clothes right in the reception room?"
"I suppose you will want to find some privacy."
"Well, I don't believe in that desert island stuff. I think the house should stand in sight of a major highway so people would point it out. You know, the Keating estate. Who the hell is Claude Stengel to have a country home while I live in a rented flat? He started out about the same time I did, and look where he is and where I am. Why, he's lucky if 2.5 men ever heard of him.
So why should he park himself in Westchester and...
And he stopped. She sat looking at him, her face serene.
Oh, God damn it, he cried. If you don't want to move to the country, why don't you just say so?
I want very much to do anything you want, Peter. To follow any idea you get all by yourself.
He remained silent for a long time.
What do we do tomorrow night? He asked, before he could stop himself.
She rose, walked to a desk, and picked up her calendar.
We have the Palmers for dinner tomorrow night, she said.
Oh, Christ, he moaned. They're such awful bores. Why do we have to have them?
She stood holding the calendar forward between the tips of her fingers, as if she were a photograph with the focus on the calendar and her own figure blurred in its background.
We have to have the Palmers, she said, so that we can get the commission for their new store building. We have to get that commission so that we can entertain the Eddingtons for dinner on Saturday. The Eddingtons have no commissions to give, but they're in the social register. The Palmers bore you, and the Eddingtons snub you, but you have to flatter people whom you despise in order to impress other people who despise you.
Why do you have to say things like that?
Would you like to look at this calendar, Peter?
Well, that's what everybody does. That's what everybody lives for.
Yes, Peter. Almost everybody. If you don't approve, why don't you say so?
Have I said anything about not approving?
He thought back carefully.
No, he admitted. No, you haven't. But it's the way you put things.
Would you rather I put it in a more involved way, as I did about Vincent Knowlton?
I'd rather...
Then he cried.
I'd rather you'd express an opinion, God damn it, just once.
She asked, in the same level monotone. Whose opinion, Peter? Gordon Prescott's? Ralston Holcomb's? Ellsworth Toohey's?
He turned to her, leaning on the arm of his chair, half rising, suddenly tense. The thing between them was beginning to take shape. He had a first hint of words that would name it.
Dominique, he said softly, reasonably. That's it.
Now I know.
I know what's been the matter all the time.
Has anything been the matter?
Wait, this is terribly important.
Dominique, you've never said, not once, what you thought. Not about anything. You've never expressed a desire.
Not of any kind.
What's wrong about that?
But it's like death.
You're not real. You're only a body.
Look, Dominique, you don't know it. I'll try to explain. You understand what death is? When a body can't move anymore, when it has no will, no meaning. You understand? Nothing. The absolute nothing. Well, your body moves, but that's all. The other, the thing inside you, you're... Oh, don't misunderstand me, I'm not talking religion. But there's no other word for it, so I'll say, your soul. Your soul doesn't exist. No will, no meaning. There's no real you anymore.
What's the real me? She asked. For the first time she looked attentive. Not compassionate, but at least attentive.
What's the real anyone? He said, encouraged.
It's not just the body. It's the soul.
What is the soul?
It's you. The thing inside you.
The thing that thinks and values and makes decisions?
Yes, yes, that's it. And the thing that feels. You've given it up.
So there are two things that one can't give up. One's thoughts and one's desires?
Yes. Oh, you do understand. So you see, you're like a corpse to everybody around you, a kind of walking death. That's worse than any active crime. It's...
Negation?
Yes, just blank negation. You're not here. You've never been here. If you'd tell me that the curtains in this room are ghastly, and if you'd rip them off and put up some you like, something of you would be real, here, in this room, but you never have. You've never told the cook what dessert you liked for dinner. You're not here, Dominique. You're not alive. Where's your I?
Where's yours, Peter? She asked quietly.
He sat still, his eyes wide. She knew that his thoughts in this moment were clear and immediate, like visual perception.
that the act of thinking was an act of seeing a procession of years behind him.
"It's not true," he said at last, his voice hollow. "It's not true."
"What is not true?"
"What you said."
"I've said nothing. I asked you a question."
His eyes were begging her to speak, to deny. She rose, stood before him, and the taut erectness of her body was a sign of life, the life he had missed and begged for, a positive quality of purpose, but the quality of a judge.
"You're beginning to see, aren't you, Peter? Shall I make it clearer? You never wanted me to be real. You never wanted anyone to be, but you didn't want me to show it. You wanted an act to help your act, a beautiful, complicated act, all twists, trimmings, and words. All words. You didn't like what I said about Vincent Knowlton. You liked it when I said the same thing under cover of virtuous sentiments. You didn't want me to believe. You only wanted me to convince you that I believed. My real soul, Peter? It's real only when it's independent. You've discovered that, haven't you? It's real only when it chooses curtains and desserts. You're right about that. Curtains, desserts, and religions, Peter, and the shapes of buildings. But you've never wanted that. You wanted a mirror. People want nothing but mirrors around them, to reflect them while they're reflecting, too. You know, like the senseless infinity you get from two mirrors facing each other across a narrow passage, usually in the more vulgar kind of hotels. Reflections of reflections and echoes of echoes, no beginning and no end, no center and no purpose. I gave you what you wanted. I became what you are, what your friends are, what most of humanity is so busy being, only without the trimmings. I didn't go around spouting book reviews to hide my emptiness of judgment. I said I had no judgment. I didn't borrow designs to hide my creative impotence. I created nothing. I didn't say that equality is a noble conception and unity the chief goal of mankind. I just agreed with everybody. You call it death, Peter? That kind of death. I've imposed it on you and on everyone around us. But you? You haven't done that. People are comfortable with you, they like you, they enjoy your presence. You've spared them the blank death. Because you've imposed it on yourself. He said nothing. She walked away from him and sat down again, waiting. He got up, he made a few steps toward her. He said, "Dominique." Then he was on his knees before her, clutching her, his head buried against her legs. "Dominique, it's not true that I never loved you. I love you, I always have. It was not just to show the others. That was not all. I loved you. There were two people, you and another person, a man, who always made me feel the same thing. Not fear exactly, but like a wall, a steep wall to climb, like a command to rise, I don't know where, but a feeling going up. I've always hated that man, but you, I wanted you, always. That's why I married you. When I knew you despised me, so you should have forgiven me that marriage. You shouldn't have taken your revenge like this. Not like this, Dominique. Dominique, I can't fight back. Who is the man you hated, Peter?
It doesn't matter.
Who is he?
Nobody.
Name him.
Howard Rourke.
She said nothing for a long time. Then she put her hand on his hair. The gesture had the form of gentleness. I never wanted to take revenge on you, Peter, she said softly.
Then, why?
I married you for my own reasons. I acted as the world demands one should act. Only I can do nothing halfway. Those who can have a fissure somewhere inside. Most people have many. They lie to themselves, not to know that. I've never lied to myself. So I had to do what you all do. Only consistently and completely. I've probably destroyed you. If I could care, I'd say I'm sorry. That was not my purpose.
Dominique, I love you. But I'm afraid. Because you've changed something in me ever since our wedding, since I said yes to you. Even if I were to lose you now, I couldn't go back to what I was before. You took something I had.
No, I took something you never had. I grant you, that's worse.
What?
It's said that the worst thing one can do to a man is to kill his self-respect, but that's not true. Self-respect is something that can't be killed. The worst thing is to kill a man's pretense at it.
Dominique, I don't want to talk.
She looked down at his face, resting against her knees, and he saw pity in her eyes. And for one moment he knew what a dreadful thing true pity is. But he kept no knowledge of it because he slammed his mind shut before the words in which he was about to preserve it. She bent down and kissed his forehead. It was the first kiss she had ever given him.
"I don't want you to suffer, Peter," she said gently. "This, now, is real. It's I. It's my own words. I don't want you to suffer. I can't feel anything else, but I feel that much."
He pressed his lips to her hand. When he raised his head, she looked at him as if for a moment he was her husband. She said,
"Peter, if you could hold on to it, to what you are now."
"I love you," he said.
They sat silently together for a long time. He felt no strain in the silence. The telephone rang. It was not the sound that destroyed the moment. It was the eagerness with which Keating jumped up and ran to answer it. She heard his voice through the open door, a voice indecent in its relief. "Hello?"
"Oh, hello, Ellsworth. No, not a thing. Free as a lark. Sure, come over. Come right over. Okie doke."
"It's Ellsworth," he said, returning to the living room. His voice was gay, and it had a touch of insolence.
"He wants to drop in."
She said nothing. He busied himself emptying ashtrays that contained a single match or one butt, gathering newspapers, adding a log to the fire that did not need it, lighting more lamps. He whistled a tune from a screen operetta. He ran to open the door when he heard the bell.
"How nice," said Toohey, coming in. "A fire, and just the two of you. Hello, Dominique. Hope I'm not intruding."
"Hello, Ellsworth," she said.
"You're never intruding," said Keating. "I can't tell you how glad I am to see you."
He pushed a chair to the fire.
"Sit down here, Ellsworth. What'll you have? You know, when I heard your voice on the phone, well, I wanted to jump and yelp like a pup."
"Don't wag your tail, though," said Toohey. "No, no drinks, thanks. How have you been, Dominique?"
"Just as I was a year ago," she said.
"But not as you were 2 years ago."
"No."
"What did we do 2 years ago this time?" Keating asked, idly.
"You weren't married," said Toohey. "Prehistorical period. Let me see, what happened then? I think the Stoddard Temple was just being completed."
"Oh, that," said Keating.
Toohey asked,
"Hear anything about your friend Rourke, Peter?"
"No. I don't think he's worked for a year or more. He's finished this time."
"Yes, I think so. What have you been doing, Peter?"
"Nothing much. Oh, I've just read The Gallant Gallstone."
"Liked it?"
"Yes. You know, I think it's a very important book, because it's true that there's no such thing as free will. We can't help what we are or what we do. It's not our fault. Nobody's to blame for anything. It's all in your background and your glands. If you're good, that's no achievement of yours. You were just lucky in your glands. If you're rotten, nobody should punish you. You were unlucky, that's all."
He was saying it defiantly, with a violence inappropriate to a literary discussion. He was not looking at Toohey, nor at Dominique, but speaking to the room, and to what that room had witnessed.
"Substantially correct," said Toohey.
"To be logical, however, we should not think of punishment for those who are rotten, since they suffered through no fault of their own, since they were unlucky and underendowed. They should deserve a compensation of some sort, more like a reward."
"Why, yes," cried Keating. That's logical."
"And just," said Toohey.
"Got the banner pretty much where you want it, Ellsworth?"
asked Dominique.
"What's that in reference to?"
"The Gallant Gallstone."
"Oh. No, I can't say I have. Not quite. There are always the imponderables."
"What are you talking about?" asked Keating.
professional gossip," said Tui.
He stretched his hands to the fire and flexed his fingers playfully.
"By the way, Peter, are you doing anything about Stone Ridge?"
"God damn it," said Keating.
"What's the matter?"
"You know what's the matter. You know the bastard better than I do. To have a project like that going up now when it's manna in the desert. And of all people to have that son of a bitch Winand doing it."
"What's the matter with Mr. Winand?"
"Oh, come, Ellsworth. You know very well if it were anyone else I'd get that commission just like that." He snapped his fingers. "I wouldn't even have to ask. The owner'd come to me, particularly when he knows that an architect like me is practically sitting on his fanny now compared to the work our office could handle. But Mr. Gale Winand, you'd think he was a holy llama who's just allergic to the air breathed by architects."
"I gather you've tried?"
"Oh, don't talk about it. It makes me sick. I think I've spent $300 feeding lunches and pouring liquor into all sorts of crappy people who said they could get me to meet him. All I got is hangovers. I think it'd be easier to meet the Pope."
"I gather you do want to get Stone Ridge?"
"Are you baiting me, Ellsworth? I'd give my right arm for it."
"That wouldn't be advisable. You couldn't make any drawings then, or pretend to. It would be preferable to give up something less tangible."
"I'd give my soul."
"Would you, Peter?" asked Dominique.
"What's on your mind, Ellsworth?" Keating snapped.
"Just a practical suggestion," said Tui. "Who has been your most effective salesman in the past and got you some of your best commissions?"
"Why, Dominique, I guess."
"That's right. And since you can't get to Winand, and it wouldn't do you any good if you did, don't you think Dominique is the one who'll be able to persuade him?"
Keating stared at him. "Are you crazy, Ellsworth?"
Dominique leaned forward. She seemed interested.
"From what I've heard," she said, "Gale Winand does not do favors for a woman unless she's beautiful. And if she's beautiful, he doesn't do it as a favor."
Tui looked at her, underscoring the fact that he offered no denial.
"It's silly," snapped Keating angrily. "How would Dominique ever get to see him?"
"By telephoning his office and making an appointment," said Tui.
"Whoever told you he'd grant it?"
"He did."
"When?"
"Late last night. Or early this morning, to be exact."
"Ellsworth,"
gasped Keating. He added,
"I don't believe it."
"I do," said Dominique. "Or Ellsworth wouldn't have started this conversation." She smiled at Tui.
"So Winand promised you to see me?"
"Yes, my dear."
"How did you work that?"
"Oh, I offered him a convincing argument. However, it would be advisable not to delay it. You should telephone him tomorrow, if you wish to do it."
"Why can't she telephone now?" said Keating. "Oh, I guess it's too late. You'll telephone first thing in the morning?"
She looked at him, her eyes half closed, and said nothing. "It's a long time since you've taken any active interest in Peter's career," said Tui. "Wouldn't you like to undertake a difficult feat like that, for Peter's sake?"
"If Peter wants me to."
"If I want you to?" cried Keating. "Are you both crazy? It's the chance of a lifetime.
He saw them both looking at him curiously. He snapped,
"Oh, rubbish!"
"What is rubbish, Peter?" asked Dominique.
"Are you going to be stopped by a lot of fool gossip? Why, any other architect's wife would crawl on her hands and knees for a chance like that to—"
"No other architect's wife would be offered the chance," said Tui. "No other architect has a wife like Dominique. You've always been so proud of that, Peter."
"Dominique can take care of herself in any circumstances."
"There's no doubt about that."
"All right, Ellsworth," said Dominique. "I'll telephone Winand tomorrow."
"Ellsworth, you're wonderful," said Keating, not looking at her.
"I believe I'd like a drink now," said Tui. "We should celebrate."
When Keating hurried out to the kitchen, Tui and Dominique looked at each other. He smiled. He glanced at the door through which Keating had gone, then nodded to her faintly, amused.
"You expected it," said Dominique.
"Of course."
"Now what's the real purpose, Ellsworth?"
"Why, I wanted to help you get Stone Ridge for Peter. It's really a terrific commission."
"Why are you so anxious to have me sleep with Winand?"
Don't you think it would be an interesting experience for all concerned?
You're not satisfied with the way my marriage has turned out, are you, Ellsworth?
Not entirely. Just about 50%. Well, nothing's perfect in this world. One gathers what one can, and then one tries further.
You were very anxious to have Peter marry me. You knew what the result would be, better than Peter or I.
Peter didn't know it at all.
Well, it worked. 50%. You got Peter Keating where you wanted him, the leading architect of the country who's now mud clinging to your galoshes.
I've never liked your style of expression, but it's always been accurate. I should have said, who's now a soul wagging its tail. Your style is gentler.
But the other 50%, Ellsworth? A failure?
Approximately total. My fault. I should have known better than to expect anyone like Peter Keating, even in the role of husband, to destroy you.
Well, you're frank.
I told you once it's the only method that will work with you. Besides, surely it didn't take you 2 years to discover what I wanted of this marriage.
So you think Gail Wynand will finish the job?
Might. What do you think?
I think I'm only a side issue again. Didn't you call it gravy once? What have you got against Wynand?
He laughed. The sound betrayed that he had not expected the question. She said contemptuously,
"Don't show that you're shocked, Ellsworth."
All right. We're taking it straight. I have nothing specific against Mr. Gail Wynand. I've been planning to have him meet you for a long time. If you want minor details, he did something that annoyed me yesterday morning. He's too observant. So I decided the time was right.
And there was Stoneridge.
And there was Stoneridge. I knew that part of it would appeal to you. You'd never sell yourself to save your country, your soul, or the life of a man you loved. But you'll sell yourself to get a commission he doesn't deserve for Peter Keating. See what will be left of you afterward. Or of Gail Wynand. I'll be interested to see it, too.
Quite correct, Ellsworth.
All of it? Even the part about a man you loved? If you did.
Yes.
You wouldn't sell yourself for Rourke? Though, of course, you don't like to hear that name pronounced.
Howard Rourke, she said evenly.
You have a great deal of courage, Dominique.
Keating returned, carrying a tray of cocktails. His eyes were feverish, and he made too many gestures. Toohey raised his glass. He said,
"To Gail Wynand and the New York Banner."
Chapter 3. Gail Wynand rose and met her halfway across his office.
"How do you do, Mrs. Keating?" he said.
"How do you do, Mr. Wynand?" said Dominique. He moved a chair for her, but when she sat down he did not cross to sit behind his desk. He stood studying her professionally, appraisingly. His manner implied a self-evident necessity, as if his reason were known to her, and there could be nothing improper in this behavior.
"You look like a stylized version of your own stylized version," he said. "As a rule, seeing the models of artworks tends to make one atheistic, but this time it's a close one between that sculptor and God."
"What sculptor?"
"The one who did that statue of you."
He had felt that there was some story behind that statue, and he became certain of it now by something in her face, a tightening that contradicted for a second the trim indifference of her self-control. "Where and when did you see that statue, Mr. Wynand?"
"In my art gallery, this morning."
"Where did you get it?"
It was his turn to show perplexity.
"But don't you know that?"
"No." "Your friend Ellsworth Toohey sent it to me, as a present."
"To get this appointment for me?"
"Not through as direct a motivation as I believe you're thinking. But in substance, yes."
"He hasn't told me that."
"Do you mind my having that statue?"
"Not particularly."
"I expected you to say that you were delighted."
"I'm not."
He sat down, informally, on the outer edge of his desk, his legs stretched out, his ankles crossed. He asked, "I gather you lost track of that statue and have been trying to find it?"
"For 2 years."
"You can't have it,"
he added, watching her.
"You might have Stoneridge."
"I shall change my mind.
I'm delighted that Tui gave it to you."
He felt a bitter little stab of triumph and of disappointment in thinking that he could read her mind and that her mind was obvious after all. He asked,
"Because it gave you this interview?"
"No, because you're the person before last in the world whom I'd like to have that statue. But Tui is last." He lost the triumph. It was not a thing which a woman intent on Stone Ridge should have said or thought.
He asked, "You didn't know that Tui had it?"
"No."
"We should get together on our mutual friend, Mr. Ellsworth Tui. I don't like being a pawn, and I don't think you do, or could ever be made to. There are too many things Mr. Tui chose not to tell. The name of that sculptor, for instance."
"He didn't tell you that?"
"No."
"Stephen Mallory."
"Mallory? Not the one who tried to..." He laughed aloud.
"What's the matter?"
"Tui told me he couldn't remember the name. That name."
"Does Mr. Tui still astonish you?"
"He has several times in the last few days. There's a special kind of subtlety in being as blatant as he's been. A very difficult kind. I almost like his artistry."
"I don't share your taste."
"Not in any field? Not in sculpture? Or architecture?"
"I'm sure not in architecture."
"Isn't that the utterly wrong thing for you to say?"
"Probably."
He looked at her. He said, "You're interesting."
"I didn't intend to be."
"That's your third mistake."
"Third?"
"The first was about Mr. Tui. In the circumstances, one would expect you to praise him to me, to quote him, to lean on his great prestige in matters of architecture."
"But one would expect you to know Ellsworth Tui. That should disqualify any quotations."
"I intended to say that to you. Had you given me the chance, you won't give me."
"That should make it more entertaining."
"You expected to be entertained?"
"I am."
"About this statue?" It was the only point of weakness he had discovered.
"No."
Her voice was hard.
"Not about the statue."
"Tell me, when was it made, and for whom?"
"Is that another thing Mr. Tui forgot?"
"Apparently."
"Do you remember a scandal about a building called the Stoddard Temple? 2 years ago. You were away at the time."
"The Stoddard Temple. How do you happen to know where I was 2 years ago?" "Wait, the Stoddard Temple, I remember. A sacrilegious church or some such object that gave the Bible Brigade a howling spree."
"Yes."
"There was..." He stopped. His voice sounded hard and reluctant, like hers. "There was the statue of a naked woman involved."
"Yes."
"I see." He was silent for a moment. Then he said, his voice harsh, as if he were holding back some anger whose object she could not guess, "I was somewhere around Bali at the time. I'm sorry all New York saw that statue before I did, but I don't read newspapers when I'm sailing. There's a standing order to fire any man who brings a wine and paper aboard the yacht."
"Have you ever seen pictures of the Stoddard Temple?"
"No." "Was the building worth the statue?"
"The statue was almost worthy of the building."
"It has been destroyed, hasn't it?"
"Yes. With the help of the Winand papers."
He shrugged. "I remember Alva Skerritt had a good time with it. A big story. Sorry I missed it. But Alva did very well. Incidentally, how did you know that I was away, and why has the fact of my absence remained in your memory?"
"It was the story that cost me my job with you."
"Your job? With me?"
"Didn't you know my name was Dominique Francon?"
Under the trim jacket, his shoulders made a sagging movement forward. It was surprise and helplessness. He stared at her quite simply. After a while, he said, "No." She smiled indifferently. She said,
"It appears that Tui wanted to make it as difficult for both of us as he could."
"To hell with Tui. This has to be understood. It doesn't make sense." "You're Dominique Francon?"
"I was."
"You worked here in this building for years?"
"For 6 years."
Why haven't I met you before? I'm sure you don't meet every one of your employees. I think you understand what I mean.
Do you wish me to state it for you?
Yes.
Why haven't I tried to meet you before?
Yes.
I had no desire to.
That, precisely, doesn't make sense.
Shall I let this go by or understand it?
I'll spare you the choice. With the kind of beauty you possess and with knowledge of the kind of reputation I am said to possess, why didn't you attempt to make a real career for yourself on the Banner?
I never wanted a real career on the Banner.
Why?
Perhaps for the same reason that makes you forbid wine and papers on your yacht.
It's a good reason, he said quietly. Then he asked, his voice casual again. Let's see, what was it you did to get fired? You went against our policy, I believe.
I tried to defend the Stoddard Temple.
Didn't you know better than to attempt sincerity on the Banner?
I intended to say that to you, if you'd given me the chance.
Are you being entertained?
I wasn't, then. I liked working here.
You're the only one who's ever said that in this building.
I must be one of two.
Who's the other?
Yourself, Mr. Wynand.
Don't be too sure of that.
Lifting his head, he saw the hint of amusement in her eyes and asked,
You said it just to trap me into that kind of a statement?
Yes, I think so, she answered placidly.
Dominique Francone, he repeated, not addressing her. I used to like your stuff. I almost wish you were here to ask for your old job.
I'm here to discuss Stoneridge.
Ah, yes, of course.
He settled back to enjoy a long speech of persuasion. He thought it would be interesting to hear what arguments she'd choose and how she'd act in the role of petitioner.
Well, what do you wish to tell me about that?
I should like you to give that commission to my husband. I understand, of course, that there's no reason why you should do so, unless I agree to sleep with you in exchange. If you consider that a sufficient reason, I am willing to do it. He looked at her silently, allowing no hint of personal reaction in his face. She sat looking up at him, faintly astonished by his scrutiny, as if her words had deserved no special attention. He could not force on himself, though he was seeking it fiercely, any other impression of her face than the incongruous one of undisturbed purity. He said,
That is what I was to suggest, but not so crudely and not on our first meeting.
I have saved you time and lies.
You love your husband very much?
I despise him.
You have a great faith in his artistic genius?
I think he's a third-rate architect.
Then why are you doing this?
It amuses me.
I thought I was the only one who acted on such motives.
You shouldn't mind. I don't believe you've ever found originality a desirable virtue, Mr. Wynand.
Actually, you don't care whether your husband gets Stoneridge or not?
No.
And you have no desire to sleep with me?
None at all.
I could admire a woman who'd put on an act like that. Only it's not an act.
It's not. Please don't begin admiring me. I have tried to avoid it.
Whenever he smiled, no obvious movement was required of his facial muscles. The hint of mockery was always there, and it merely came into sharper focus for a moment, to recede imperceptibly again. The focus was sharper now. As a matter of fact, he said, your chief motive is I, after all. The desire to give yourself to me. He saw the glance she could not control, and added, No, don't enjoy the thought that I have fallen into so gross an error. I didn't mean it in the usual sense, but in its exact opposite. Didn't you say you considered me the person before last in the world? You don't want Stoneridge. You want to sell yourself for the lowest motive to the lowest person you can find.
I didn't expect you to understand that, she said simply.
You want, men do that sometimes, not women, to express through the sexual act your utter contempt for me.
No, Mr. Wynand, for myself.
The thin line of his mouth moved faintly, as if his lips had caught the first hint of a personal revelation, an involuntary one, and therefore a weakness, and were holding it tight while he spoke. Most people go to very great length in order to convince themselves of their self-respect.
Yes.
And, of course,
A quest for self-respect is proof of its lack.
Yes.
Do you see the meaning of a quest for self-contempt?
That I lack it?
And that you'll never achieve it?
I didn't expect you to understand that either.
I won't say anything else. Or I'll stop being the person before last in the world and I'll become unsuitable to your purpose. He rose. Shall I tell you formally that I accept your offer? She inclined her head in agreement. As a matter of fact, he said, I don't care whom I choose to build Stone Ridge. I've never hired a good architect for any of the things I've built. I give the public what it wants. I was stuck for a choice this time because I'm tired of the bunglers who've worked for me, and it's hard to decide without standards or reason. I'm sure you don't mind my saying this. I'm really grateful to you for giving me a much better motive than any I could hope to find.
I'm glad you didn't say that you've always admired the work of Peter Keating.
You didn't tell me how glad you were to join the distinguished list of Gail Winans' mistresses.
You may enjoy my admitting it if you wish, but I think we'll get along very well together.
Quite likely. At least you've given me a new experience, to do what I've always done, but honestly. Shall I now begin to give you my orders? I won't pretend they're anything else.
If you wish.
You'll go with me for a 2 months cruise on my yacht. We'll sail in 10 days. When we come back, you'll be free to return to your husband, with the contract for Stone Ridge.
Very well.
I should like to meet your husband. Will you both have dinner with me Monday night?
Yes, if you wish.
When she rose to leave, he asked, Shall I tell you the difference between you and your statue?
No,
but I want to. It's startling to see the same elements used in two compositions with opposite themes. Everything about you in that statue is the theme of exaltation, but your own theme is suffering.
Suffering? I'm not conscious of having shown that.
You haven't. That's what I meant. No happy person can be quite so impervious to pain. Winand telephoned his art dealer and asked him to arrange a private showing of Stephen Mallory's work. He refused to meet Mallory in person. He never met those whose work he liked. The art dealer executed the order in great haste. Winand bought 5 of the pieces he saw and paid more than the dealer had hoped to ask. Mr. Mallory would like to know, said the dealer, what brought him to your attention.
I saw one of his works.
Which one?
It doesn't matter.
Toohey had expected Winand to call for him after the interview with Dominique. Winand had not called. But a few days later, meeting Toohey by chance in the city room, Winand asked aloud, Mr. Toohey, have so many people tried to kill you that you can't remember their names? Toohey smiled and said,
I'm sure quite so many would like to.
You flatter your fellow men, said Winand, walking away. Peter Keating stared at the brilliant room of the restaurant. It was the most exclusive place in town and the most expensive. Keating gloated, chewing the thought that he was here as the guest of Gail Winand. He tried not to stare at the gracious elegance of Winand's figure across the table. He blessed Winand for having chosen to give this dinner in a public place. People were gaping at Winand, discreetly and with practiced camouflage, but gaping nevertheless. And their attention included the 2 guests at Winand's table. Dominique sat between the 2 men. She wore a white silk dress with long sleeves and a cowl neck, a nun's garment that acquired the startling effect of an evening gown only by being so flagrantly unsuited to that purpose. She wore no jewelry. Her gold hair looked like a hood. The dull white silk moved in angular planes with the movements of her body, revealing it in a manner of cold innocence. The body of a sacrificial object publicly offered, beyond the need of concealment or desire. Keating found it unattractive. He noticed that Winand seemed to admire it. Someone at a distant table stared in their direction insistently. Someone tall and bulky. Then the big shape rose to its feet, and Keating recognized Ralston Holcomb hurrying toward them.
Peter, my boy, so glad to see you,
boomed Holcomb, shaking his hand, bowing to Dominique, conspicuously ignoring Winand.
Where have you been hiding? Why don't we see you around any more?
They had had luncheon together 3 days ago.
Wynand had risen and stood leaning forward a little, courteously. Keating hesitated, then with obvious reluctance said, "Mr. Wynand, Mr. Holcomb."
"Not Mr. Gale Wynand," said Holcomb with splendid innocence.
"Mr. Holcomb, if you saw one of the cough-drop Smith brothers in real life, would you recognize him?" asked Wynand.
"Why, I guess so," said Holcomb, blinking.
"My face, Mr. Holcomb, is just as much of a public bromide."
Holcomb muttered a few benevolent generalities and escaped.
Wynand smiled affectionately.
"You didn't have to be afraid of introducing Mr. Holcomb to me, Mr. Keating, even though he is an architect."
"Afraid, Mr. Wynand?"
"Unnecessarily, since it's all settled. Hasn't Mrs. Keating told you that Stone Ridge is yours?"
"I...
no, she hasn't told me. I didn't know." Wynand was smiling, but the smile remained fixed, and Keating felt compelled to go on talking until some sign stopped him. "I hadn't quite hoped. Not so soon. Of course I thought this dinner might be a sign. Help you to decide."
He blurted out involuntarily,
"Do you always throw surprises like that? Just like that?"
"Whenever I can," said Wynand gravely.
"I shall do my best to deserve this honor and live up to your expectations, Mr. Wynand."
"I have no doubt about that," said Wynand. He had said little to Dominique tonight. His full attention seemed centered on Keating.
"The public has been kind to my past endeavors," said Keating, "but I shall make Stone Ridge my best achievement."
"That is quite a promise, considering the distinguished list of your works."
"I had not hoped that my works were of sufficient importance to attract your attention, Mr. Wynand, but I know them quite well. The Cosmo Slotnick building, which is pure Michelangelo."
Keating's face spread in incredulous pleasure. He knew that Wynand was a great authority on art, and would not make such comparisons lightly.
"The Prudential Bank building, which is genuine Palladio, the Slattern department store, which is snitched Christopher Wren."
Keating's face had changed.
"Look what an illustrious company I get for the price of one. Isn't it quite a bargain?"
Keating smiled, his face tight, and said, "I've heard about your brilliant sense of humor, Mr. Wynand."
"Have you heard about my descriptive style?"
"What do you mean?" Wynand half turned in his chair and looked at Dominique, as if he were inspecting an inanimate object.
"Your wife has a lovely body, Mr. Keating. Her shoulders are too thin, but admirably in scale with the rest of her. Her legs are too long, but that gives her the elegance of line you'll find in a good yacht. Her breasts are beautiful, don't you think?"
"Architecture is a crude profession, Mr. Wynand." Keating tried to laugh. "It doesn't prepare one for the superior sort of sophistication."
"You don't understand me, Mr. Keating?"
"If I didn't know you were a perfect gentleman, I might misunderstand it. But you can't fool me."
"That is just what I'm trying not to do."
"I appreciate compliments, Mr. Wynand, but I'm not conceited enough to think that we must talk about my wife."
"Why not, Mr. Keating?"
"It is considered good form to talk of the things one has, or will have, in common."
"Mr. Wynand, I don't understand."
"Shall I be more explicit?"
No.
"Shall we drop the subject of Stone Ridge?"
"Oh, let's talk about Stone Ridge.
But we are, Mr. Keating." Keating looked at the room about them. He thought that things like this could not be done in such a place. The fastidious magnificence made it monstrous. He wished it were a dank cellar. He thought blood on paving stones. All right, but not blood on a drawing-room rug.
"Now I know this is a joke, Mr. Wynand," he said.
"It is my turn to admire your sense of humor, Mr. Keating.
Things like this aren't being done."
"That's not what you mean at all, Mr. Keating. You mean they're being done all the time, but not talked about."
"I didn't think..."
"You thought it before you came here. You didn't mind. I grant you I'm behaving abominably. I'm breaking all the rules of charity. It's extremely cruel, to be honest."
"Please, Mr. Wynand, let's drop it. I don't know what I'm supposed to do."
"That's simple. You're supposed to slap my face."
Keating giggled.
"You were supposed to do that several minutes ago."
Keating noticed that his palms were wet, and that he was trying to support his weight by holding on to the napkin on his lap. Wynand and Dominique were eating, slowly and graciously, as if they were at another table. Keating thought that they were not human bodies. Either one of them. Something had vanished. The light of the crystal fixtures in the room was the radiance of X-rays that ate through, not to the bones, but deeper. They were souls, he thought, sitting at a dinner table, souls held within evening clothes, lacking the intermediate shape of flesh, terrifying in naked revelation, terrifying because he expected to see torturers, but saw a great innocence. He wondered what they saw, what his own clothes contained if his physical shape had gone. No, said Wynand. You don't want to do that, Mr. Keating. But of course you don't have to. Just say that you don't want any of it. I won't mind. There's Mr. Ralston Holcomb across the room. He could build Stone Ridge as well as you could. I don't know what you mean, Mr. Wynand, whispered Keating. His eyes were fixed upon the tomato aspic on his salad plate. It was soft and shivering. It made him sick. Wynand turned to Dominique. Do you remember our conversation about a certain quest, Mrs. Keating? I said it was a quest at which you would never succeed. Look at your husband. He's an expert, without effort. That is the way to go about it. Match that sometime. Don't bother to tell me that you can't. I know it. You're an amateur, my dear. Keating thought that he must speak again, but he couldn't. Not as long as that salad was there before him. The terror came from that plate, not from the fastidious monster across the table. The rest of the room was warm and safe. He lurched forward, and his elbows swept the plate off the table. He made a kind of sound expressing regrets. Somebody's shape came up, there were polite voices of apology, and the mess vanished from the carpet. Keating heard a voice saying, "Why are you doing this?" Saw two faces turned to him, and knew that he had said it. "Mr. Wynand is not doing it to torture you, Peter," said Dominique calmly. "He's doing it for me, to see how much I can take." "That's true, Mrs. Keating," said Wynand. "Partly true. The other part is to justify myself." "In whose eyes?" "Yours. And my own, perhaps." "Do you need to?" "Sometimes. The Banner is a contemptible paper, isn't it? Well, I have paid with my honor for the privilege of holding a position where I can amuse myself by observing how honor operates in other men." His own clothes, thought Keating, contained nothing now. Because the two faces did not notice him any longer. He was safe. His place at that table was empty. He wondered from a great indifferent distance why the two were looking at each other quietly, not like enemies, not like fellow executioners, but like comrades. 2 days before they were to sail, Wynand telephoned Dominique late in the evening. "Could you come over right now?" he asked, and hearing a moment's silence, added, "Oh, not what you're thinking. I live up to my agreements. You'll be quite safe. I just would like to see you tonight." "All right," she said, and was astonished to hear a quiet, "Thank you." When the elevator door slid open in the private lobby of his penthouse, he was waiting there, but did not let her step out. He joined her in the elevator. "I don't want you to enter my house," he said. "We're going to the floor below." The elevator operator looked at him, amazed. The car stopped and opened before a locked door. Wynand unlocked it and let her step out first, following her into the art gallery. She remembered that this was the place no outsider ever entered. She said nothing. He offered no explanation. For hours, she walked silently through the vast rooms, looking at the incredible treasures of beauty. There was a deep carpet and no sound of steps, no sounds from the city outside, no windows. He followed her, stopping when she stopped. His eyes went with hers from object to object. At times his glance moved to her face. She passed without stopping by the statue from the Stoddard Temple.
He did not urge her to stay, nor to hurry, as if he had turned the place over to her. She decided when she wished to leave, and he followed her to the door. Then she asked, "Why did you want me to see this? It won't make me think better of you. Worse, perhaps."
"Yes, I'd expect that," he said quietly, "if I had thought of it that way. But I didn't. I just wanted you to see it."
Chapter 4. The sun had set when they stepped out of the car in the spread of sky and sea, a green sky over a sheet of mercury. Tracings of fire remained at the edges of the clouds and in the brass fittings of the yacht. The yacht was like a white streak of motion, a sensitive body strained against the curb of stillness. Dominique looked at the gold letters, "I do," on the delicate white bow.
"What does that name mean?" she asked.
"It's an answer," said Wynand, "to people long since dead, though perhaps they are the only immortal ones. You see, the sentence I heard most often in my childhood was, 'You don't run things around here.'" She remembered hearing that he had never answered this question before. He had answered her at once. He had not seemed conscious of making an exception. She felt a sense of calm in his manner, strange and new to him, an air of quiet finality. When they went aboard, the yacht started moving, almost as if Wynand's steps on deck had served as contact. He stood at the rail, not touching her. He looked at the long brown shore that rose and fell against the sky, moving away from them. Then he turned to her. She saw no new recognition in his eyes, no beginning, but only the continuation of a glance, as if he had been looking at her all the time. When they went below, he walked with her into her cabin. He said, "Please let me know if there's anything you wish," and walked out through an inside door. She saw that it led to his bedroom. He closed the door and did not return. She moved idly across the cabin. A smear of reflection followed her on the lustrous surfaces of the pale satinwood paneling. She stretched out in a low armchair, her ankles crossed, her arms thrown behind her head, and watched the porthole turning from green to a dark blue. She moved her hand, switched on a light. The blue vanished and became a glazed black circle. The steward announced dinner. Wynand knocked at her door and accompanied her to the dining salon. His manner puzzled her. It was gay, but the sense of calm in the gaiety suggested a peculiar earnestness. She asked when they were seated at the table, "Why did you leave me alone?" "I thought you might want to be alone."
"To get used to the idea?"
"If you wish to put it that way."
"I was used to it before I came to your office."
"Yes, of course. Forgive me for implying any weakness in you. I know better. By the way, you haven't asked me where we're going."
"That, too, would be weakness."
"True. I'm glad you don't care, because I never have any definite destination. The ship is not for going to places, but for getting away from them. When I stop at a port, it's only for the sheer pleasure of leaving it. I always think, here's one more spot that can't hold me."
"I used to travel a great deal. I always felt just like that. I've been told it's because I'm a hater of mankind."
"You're not foolish enough to believe that, are you?"
"I don't know."
"Surely you've seen through that particular stupidity. I mean the one that claims the pig is the symbol of love for humanity, the creature that accepts anything. As a matter of fact, the person who loves everybody and feels at home everywhere is the true hater of mankind. He expects nothing of men, so no form of depravity can outrage him."
"You mean the person who says that there's some good in the worst of us?"
"I mean the person who has the filthy insolence to claim that he loves equally the man who made that statue of you and the man who makes a Mickey Mouse balloon to sell on street corners. I mean the person who loves the men who prefer the Mickey Mouse to your statue, and there are many of that kind. I mean the person who loves Joan of Arc and the salesgirls in dress shops on Broadway with an equal fervor. I mean the person who loves your beauty and the women he sees in a subway, the kind that can't cross their knees and show flesh hanging publicly over their garters, with the same sense of exaltation. I mean the person who loves the clean, steady, unfrightened eyes of man looking through a telescope, and the white stare of an imbecile, equally. I mean quite a large, generous, magnanimous company.
Is it you who hate mankind, Mrs. Keating?
You're saying all the things that, since I can remember, since I began to see and think, have been...
She stopped. Have been torturing you, of course. One can't love man without hating most of the creatures who pretend to bear his name. It's one or the other. One doesn't love God and sacrilege impartially, except when one doesn't know that sacrilege has been committed, because one doesn't know God.
What will you say if I give you the answer people usually give me? That love is forgiveness.
I'll say it's an indecency of which you're not capable, even though you think you're an expert in such matters.
Or that love is pity.
Oh, keep still. It's bad enough to hear things like that. To hear them from you is revolting, even as a joke.
What's your answer?
That love is reverence and worship and glory and the upward glance, not a bandage for dirty sores. But they don't know it. Those who speak of love most promiscuously are the ones who've never felt it. They make some sort of feeble stew out of sympathy, compassion, contempt, and general indifference, and they call it love. Once you've felt what it means to love as you and I know it, the total passion for the total height, you're incapable of anything less.
As you and I know it?
It's what we feel when we look at a thing like your statue. There's no forgiveness in that, and no pity, and I'd want to kill the man who claims that there should be. But you see, when he looks at your statue, he feels nothing. That, or a dog with a broken paw, it's all the same to him. He even feels that he's done something nobler by bandaging the dog's paw than by looking at your statue. So if you seek a glimpse of greatness, if you want exaltation, if you ask for God and refuse to accept the washing of wounds as substitute, you're called a hater of humanity, Mrs. Keating, because you've committed the crime of knowing a love humanity has not learned to deserve.
Mr. Wynand, have you read what I got fired for?
No, I didn't then. I don't dare to now.
Why?
He ignored the question. He said, smiling, "And so you came to me and said, 'You're the vilest person on earth. Take me, so that I'll learn self-contempt. I lack that which most people live by. They find life endurable while I can't.' Do you see now what you've shown?"
"I didn't expect it to be seen."
"No, not by the publisher of the New York Banner, of course. That's all right. I expected a beautiful slut who is a friend of Ellsworth Toohey." They laughed together. She thought it was strange that they could talk without strain, as if he had forgotten the purpose of this journey. His calm had become a contagious sense of peace between them. She watched the unobtrusively gracious way their dinner was served. She looked at the white tablecloth against the deep red of the mahogany walls. Everything on the yacht had an air that made her think it was the first truly luxurious place she had ever entered. The luxury was secondary, a background so proper to him that it could be ignored. The man humbled his own wealth. She had seen people of wealth, stiff and awed before that which represented their ultimate goal. The splendor of this place was not the aim, not the final achievement of the man who leaned casually across the table. She wondered what his aim had been.
"This ship is becoming to you," she said.
She saw a look of pleasure in his eyes, and of gratitude. "Thank you. Is the art gallery?"
"Yes. Only that's less excusable."
"I don't want you to make excuses for me."
He said it simply, without reproach.
They had finished dinner. She waited for the inevitable invitation. It did not come. He sat smoking, talking about the yacht and the ocean. Her hand came to rest accidentally on the tablecloth, close to his. She saw him looking at it. She wanted to jerk her hand away, but forced herself to let it lie still. "Now," she thought. He got up. "Let's go on deck," he said. They stood at the rail and looked at a black void. Space was not to be seen, only felt by the quality of the air against their faces. A few stars gave reality to the empty sky. A few sparks of white fire in the water gave life to the ocean. He stood, slouched carelessly, one arm raised, grasping a stanchion.
She saw the sparks flowing, forming the edges of waves, framed by the curve of his body. That, too, was becoming to him. She said, "May I name another vicious bromide you've never felt?"
"Which one?"
"You've never felt how small you were when looking at the ocean."
He laughed. "Never. Nor looking at the planets, nor at mountain peaks, nor at the Grand Canyon. Why should I? When I look at the ocean, I feel the greatness of man. I think of man's magnificent capacity that created this ship to conquer all that senseless space. When I look at mountain peaks, I think of tunnels and dynamite. When I look at the planets, I think of airplanes."
"Yes. And that particular sense of sacred rapture men say they experience in contemplating nature. I've never received it from nature, only from..."
She stopped. "From what?"
"Buildings," she whispered. "Skyscrapers."
"Why didn't you want to say that?"
"I don't know.